Hello everyone, welcome to Overflow of Genius, a modest film discussion with Fareed and Raj. My name is Raj Ranade, I'm the film critic at the Lexington Ace Weekly, and I'm here with my good friend Fareed Ben Youssef, a film scholar and PhD candidate at UC Berkeley.
Hello!
So for our next few podcasts, Fareed and I are going to try out something a little bit different. We've decided to try out a retrospective on a year that was really pretty spectacular for American cinema. It's been 5 years since 2007 rolled around, but there's at least three movies, maybe even four, that continue to stand up as true American masterpieces. And what we thought we'd do is go through and talk about some of our favorites from that year, all of which are available on DVD and Blu-ray and various streaming services, so you can hopefully join in the fun with us. We'll call it a kind of online movie discussion club. And the first of the great films from that year that we're going to be talking about is a film about a real-life serial killer that haunted San Francisco while the optimistic 60s were fading into the cynical 70s. It's from director David Fincher, and it's called Zodiac.
Dear editor, this is the murderer of the two teenagers last Christmas at Lake Herman and the girl on the 4th of July.
I want you to print this cipher on the front page of your paper.
He wants his code in the afternoon edition.
Ray Smith, don't you have my cartoon to finish?
The Zodiac killer has come to San Francisco.
Another letter. School children make nice targets.
He gave himself a name.
So, Fareed, watching Zodiac again, I think I was even more impressed by the film than when I first saw it in 2007. But I think this time I was actually impressed in spite of the script, not really because of it at all. The guy who wrote this film, James Vanderbilt, he was known at the time for these cheesy horror movies. There was this movie called Darkness Falls with this slasher called The Tooth Fairy. And then there was this action movie called The Rundown starring The Rock. You know, neither of which are exactly script-driven movies, let's say. And there's a lot of cornball dialogue going around this movie. You've got these cops trying to solve this case, but they're doing this Hill Street Blues banter kind of thing. And then you've got Jake Gyllenhaal's kind of Boy Scout investigator cartoonist character, who sometimes seems like a bit of a caricature almost. But I think what not only saves this movie but really elevates it to pretty great heights is the unique way that David Fincher has decided to tackle this material. So, Fareed, what do you think it is about David Fincher's approach here that makes this movie so special?
Well, you know, you have a movie about a serial killer, and you follow these various intrepid reporters and detectives on their way to crack the case. You know, this is the fodder for many a mystery and many a yawn, if I might be so bold. But I love it. I think this movie is sort of startling. Even the clunky dialogue, I think, in this world that's sort of a little stranger, this 1970s that really doesn't fall upon itself as such. Early on in the film, you have one of Vanderbilt's delicious sort of establishment of the Gyllenhaal character who plays the cartoonist Robert Graysmith, who decides to put it on the line and crack the unsolvable case to sort of elaborate and crystallize who he is. They have that very rich and subtle line where the Boy Scout says, "I like puzzles." Oh, that was so. I mean, really, a lot of depth.
You gotta read between the lines, Free. That's how this works.
Yeah, that's the thing. That these movies so rich. But here's the thing: that you have the investigators see the crime as a game to solve, and these characters are oblivious in many ways to the human stakes involved. It's that weirdness of being trapped within the obsession of these characters, seeing the world as a puzzle where the stakes involved, where people die and suffer, are somehow lost in that obsession to find the missing puzzle piece that puts the whole tapestry into a coherent order. Does the film ever achieve that? And maybe that's part of the root of many of its most interesting questions. It's still a film that I think really is obsessed with provision, obsessed with detail, and as sort of in awe and horrified by the bureaucracy of our criminal investigation as it is by the actual crime themselves. I mean, what do you think? What did you think, Raj, defined this film as apart from your usual serial killer picture?
Yeah, you know, when you talk about a movie like this, which, let's clarify, is a true story about this killer who was never caught, The term that gets used is a police procedural. And I've never seen a movie that's been more obsessed with procedure than this one is. You know, your first murders that you see here are sort of your standard serial killer movie sort of attacks on kids together at a, like a lover's lane kind of deal. But as you move forward, there's this interesting emphasis on details that a lot of movies would avoid. There's that shot where we're cycling through a bunch of law enforcement agencies examining the first Zodiac letter that came to the newspaper office. And you watch the screen titles. One shows that the first scene is 6 hours after the letter. Then the next shot is 4.5 hours. The next shot is 3, then 2. There's this weird precision to everything here, which really gets interesting in one of the later murder scenes where you have this cab driver that gets murdered. Now, there was no surviving witness to this crime, unlike the first two. And so what Fincher does is that he stays outside the cab with this God's eye camera view of this car driving. He refuses to dramatize like any conversation with the cabbie or anything like that, which you might expect in a thriller like this. No, I mean, he's going to stick to the details of the police report, where this guy was picked up, where he got out, where the cabbie was shot. You know, the only the stuff that really can be known. And then later, there's that scene with a woman with a baby who gets picked up on the street by someone who might have been the Zodiac killer. And there's a weird blank in the middle of that scene. You know, he says, before I kill you, I'm going to throw your baby out the window. And then that strange cut to black. And then you see her later standing up on the roadside calling out for help. And now, the movie doesn't even bother to say this, but if you look it up, you find out that the police reports that covered that incident, the ones who talked to the woman, those reports contradict each other. Even though they both talk to the same woman, there's a disagreement about what she said, what really happened. So there's no clear historical record. And so Fincher just decides to kind of elide that moment entirely. And there's something haunting about that, because the rest of this movie is going to bombard you with data about every possible detail of this investigation that you could possibly care about. You know, down to what Jake Gyllenhaal's character's favorite cocktail is. And then there's a half hour about a suspect that turns out to be a dead end. But, you know, those key scenes with those murders are this tantalizing mystery. And that mystery is part of what ends up consuming the characters in this movie. And, you know, this turns out to not be a simple serial killer thriller. It's an exploration of something a lot more cosmic, I'd say. This question of epistemology. You know, what can be known about history? Now, Fincher's answer here is clearly not everything. And then, you know, what do you do with that then? How do you cope with this idea of not being able to know things, the impossibility of knowing certain facts about history? Which I think is a very powerful idea and not something you see in a movie like this very often. Now, Free, do you think this movie kind of gets at those sort of cosmic concerns?
It's curious because I think, you know, in some ways, it's the film is aware of itself as a genre picture to some degree, you know, ignoring the fact that Graysmith is the only guy that wants to get to the truth, and he's a cartoonist. The person, like a genre filmmaker, supposed to take reality and exaggerate it and make it into a sort of a broader caricature. Here, cinema seems to permeate this universe. You know, I think in the Graysmith's apartment, the cartoonist's apartment, there's a tableau of I Died a Thousand Times, a noir tale with Jack Palance about a manhunt. And this reference, of course, puts the film in a noir tradition, but at the same time, it valorizes the genre for having a satisfying ending that real life couldn't emulate. I mean, even the fact that you talked about its detail focus, in an homage in maintaining its strict adherence to detail to suspense films of the past like Psycho and Dressed to Kill, where the serial killer was often changed and placed in different costumes and played by different people so you would never ultimately know the true identity. Fincher does the very same thing here, and in so doing strives illustrate how these details, the fact that the serial killer is never the same between scenes, is always a different actor playing him, that there is the possibility that genre can get somewhere darker, and it might valorize the sort of classic noirs of the past, which again, film buffs should just, you know, mine the mise-en-scene, the staging for these incidental details. But the very fact that genre has the possibility of transcending the sort of news media or sort of classic history films to really get at something starker, like is there a point to history? Do we have limits to our own knowledge? Remember, this is a film that doesn't end with "that's the guy who shot me." It ends with "I'm very sure." Maybe that's the man who shot me. That sense of inability to sort of have a precise read on this case really sets it apart and gives it that ultimate possibility of being a genre film that really takes the full potential of the film type to explore these type of cosmic and sort of terrifying questions, whether it be the chase for a killer, whether that be a 1970s Zodiac, or an impotent administration's chase for another terrorist figure, in the case of perhaps maybe Osama bin Laden, which the remember 2007, Osama wasn't caught, and you have this film which talks about the inability for these organizations to get a read on this enemy. The enemy as being a mass mediated force that's ever present in radio and television, and yet somehow elides the possibilities, intelligence possibility of even the smartest and strongest deciphering arms of the government chasing him. It's startling, and I think that film has higher stakes than your genre film, which sets it apart. But I guess my question to you, Raj, is does it stand apart from Fincher's work up to that point? Do you think that there is something in this serial killer film that's different from the Panic Rooms and the Seven and Fight Clubs that have preceded it?
Yeah, I think there's a plainness to this film that was completely new to David Fincher's work at the time, which turned out to be a really big benefit, I think. Seven and Fight Club and The Game, all good movies, especially the latter, actually, but all based on some kind of big gimmick or some kind of high concept idea. The big story twists that really dominate over everything else in the film, like the big Tyler Durden reveal in Fight Club and the same kind of thing in Seven and The Game. And none of those are bad movies at all. All of them are quite good, but because they're doing this kind of, gimmicky kind of thing, they can't dig into ideas and themes in the same kind of way. They're too busy playing this sort of shell game with the audience. And here, Fincher's free from that. And now he can dig into these ideas about obsession and, knowledge of history and uncertainty in the universe, that kind of thing. Because, he's free from, not just from the gimmick, actually, but he's free from a traditional story structure, even. Since there was obviously no big finish in history where the Zodiac was ever caught. And I find that absolutely fascinating. Although, it does lead to the charge that a lot of critics have leveled at this movie, which is that it's an emotionally cold piece of work. Fareed, did that bother you? The lack of the kind of emotional current that you might get in a movie like this otherwise?
Well, I think, it's about where the film situates us. And in some ways, the film is a bit sort of subversive in that, sure, there's going to be a relatively monotone style of performance that seems to play less to bad acting than more of a nod to the disaffected protagonists that typically haunt noirs, your Philip Marlowe's who have seen it all and have a wry humor towards it as they're trying to make their way through or solve the case. Though there definitely is that, but I think in some ways the emotion is of the film is less the actual characters. Then the fact that we get to see these people who, these characters oblivious to the human stakes and that are seeing their world as a puzzle. The insidious dimension of Zodiac, and I think where a lot of its emotional power comes from, is that the film, through its rhythms, by bringing us into these characters, they make us see the world in similarly dispassionate lights, where we've gone from the classic opener of the suspense film in The Lover's Lane Killing that opens the movie to sort of desperately trying to figure out or sort of glean the clues that occur in the later acts of violence in the film. The film is trying to change our mode of viewing of these characters and bring us to that deadness, that deadened psyche of these characters.
Right. What this movie does, I think that's pretty rare, is that it makes a play for empathy much more than it does sympathy, I guess, which is kind of rare in a type of drama that doesn't rely on, goosing the audience with like suspense, set pieces, that kind of thing. It's kind of like Tinker Tailor's Soldier Spy, the thriller from last year in that regard. It's a movie that kind of wants you to feel what the characters are feeling by putting you up to the same kind of information overload that they're receiving. You know, there was a joke. Nathan Lee reviewed this film for the Village Voice way back when, and he talked about a friend who didn't like the movie saying that he felt like, well, he was just stuck in a filing cabinet for 3 hours, to which Nathan Lee responded, that's kind of the point. It's a very well-acted, well-shot file cabinet, but, you know, that information overload is a very present factor here, as, you know, that information overload is there to kind of show you what the characters are feeling. And, you know, it doesn't just tie into the details of the case either, but I think it serves, like, as Lee had argued, as a kind of allegory for the internet age, the modern information age. You know, modern life consists of plowing through way more information than at any time in the past. This constant stream of data flying out of your cell phone, your computer screen. And that can certainly have a deadening effect. And I think that's kind of what you're seeing play out in this movie on a much grander scale. And I think it works because the performers are, for the most part, very good at showing that kind of breakdown. The standout for me is Robert Downey Jr., whose performance is heartbreaking on a couple levels. One is that he's just a great actor, and you know, he sells his role very well. But there's this real-life resonance, too, to seeing Downey Jr. playing this character whose, you know, demons drag him into heavy drug and alcohol abuse.
Tony Stark was not the first. It was a bit Stargirl, if I might suggest. These characters... Sorry, I had to do the pun. But yeah, these characters are broken down. I think it reminds me, one of the great little notes that you see how this possibility that if we go in the sort of the epistemological sort of how worldviews are formed, the film maybe at its most insidious. I use that word again. How many times? It's a drinking game. Has that possibility of these characters who want the clues, who want some easy answers, and themselves by bringing the movie or cinematic view that sort of suggests that each case leads to a finale where the killer is named and where everything is wrapped up in a nice little package. There's that startling moment that really allows you to appreciate, I think, the richness of the staging when Grace Smith goes to see Paul Avery after the Zodiac murders have happened, and you know it's sort of yesterday's news to some degree. He goes and sees them on the houseboat, and let's ignore for the fact the supremely delicious and again aesthetically this movie's quite pleasing for its interplay of light and shadow, which again suggests the neo-noir, but I just give this film it's this absolute high contrast that exists within a relatively monotone and cold color palette. You have Robert Downey sort of in a shaft of light, the skinny man, and the whiteness of the light seems to reduce him into a specter, as though the chase himself has made him into a living ghost, unable to continue because of the possibility that this case continues to remain unsolved. But in the background, you have, I think, one of the most powerful uses of Pong ever put to film. You have this Pong game that just, remember, the 70s. It's called shorthand for setting up the time period. But you have, instead of that, it becomes almost an electric mimic of the heartbeat on a life support system. You know, you have that sort of electrified pulse, and every time the game loses a point, you just hear this bap, as though it's flatlining. And so through that, he's suggesting the possibility that these characters are living a flatlined existence. And I think we went just to sort of reinforce the emotion. He's very good at this film in getting to this problem of you know, information in this fun age that we live in, of getting the emotional sort of thrust of the film via these expressionistic images that recall film noir, where the psychic interior of these monotone characters, or to some degree, are spread outwards, so that we see the broken shell of the man by the piercing shaft of light upon him, along with the orchestra of an errant pong machine charting his broken heartbeat. I mean, Raj, I'm getting emotional here, man.
Right. And also, you talk about the lighting and the aesthetic that Fincher has put together for this film. And it's worth mentioning that Zodiac was the first pure digital film that was ever shot. There were other films before it that were shot to digital cameras, but then they were transferred to video or film for editing. Movies like Michael Mann's Collateral, and I think Miami Vice was before that. But you know, this one, on the other hand, was shot directly to a hard drive and edited with a computer-only process. And it's interesting because it gives this movie this kind of weirdly modern sheen in a movie where Fincher is otherwise working really hard to ensure that everything is period authentic. You know, every single sideburn is in place and every car model is period appropriate and the soundtrack is all precisely chosen tunes from the right time period. But then you have this kind of new sort of digital look to the film. And one of the things about digital cinematography, when you shoot night with a digital camera, it's much better at picking up light in nighttime settings than a regular film camera is. And so, you know, the many nighttime scenes in this movie have this strange, eerie clarity to them, which is almost like a taunt to the characters in the film. You know, you look into that night sky and everything is crystal clear, but that clear vision is being used to tell a story where the facts are almost always completely murky. And also, you know, this digital look, it ties into that idea of the film, again, as a metaphor for a modern internet age. You know, this 1970s story being brought to us through this very modern, digital, high-tech kind of medium. And, of course, you know, this idea of examining the internet age and its effects on our psyches and our relationships with each other, that was, of course, the focus of Fincher's 2010 film, The Social Network, about Mark Zuckerberg's founding of Facebook. And to an extent, even the girl with the dragon tattoo from last year was fascinated by technology to an extent that a lot of contemporary thrillers are not.
I think
so. Zodiac's concerns kind of flowered into this series of interesting films, although I still think that this one takes the cake as Fincher's best work for sure.
You know, that's the thing. I like to think that behind foreshadowing the thematic obsessions of two of his later three films in terms of information and history and all that lovely business, technology and obsession with detail to some degree, I think that the film allows us to gain a glimpse at an aware filmmaker who, in not only is he critical of, you know, this information and detail obsession, but perhaps is sort of autocritical of his own practice to some degree, as a filmmaker who works within the system, one for me, one for them type of thing. And I think he does a lot of them for them, and hopefully to get some me in whatever he finds himself in. I think we should end this, Raj, on just this, what I'm going to say is the ultimate David Fincher moment, which illustrates his place as a filmmaker who will work within the system in order, but in an effort always to buck it. Bear with me, if you will, because this was a bit of a stretch. No, wait, is that how we should sort of, you should caveat any interpretation? Before I begin, this is crazy. All right, let's go for it. No, it's just that the very first time we see a David Fincher film, it appears over an image where the characters are bucking the system. No, not by, you know, going against the sort of police chief and using maximum force to take down a perp or something else, but rather in the more sort of mundane task of a boy taking too much toothbrush, taking too much toothpaste and swallowing. Now, this is, you seem like a strange moment, but that,
go ahead.
You have this moment where these characters, in the very moment that the bucking of the system occurs, not on some macro sort of cinematic, like, you know, you have nothing on me, chief, but rather that in the quotidian task of just brushing your teeth, you're able to swallow. You're able to get some of that poison, getting us in a sort of clean, shimmery place, brushing your teeth, creating popular Hollywood cinema, but in some ways laying us, giving us a little gentle hint of poison. And I think in some ways that this is an odd, but I think perfect encapsulation of what David Fincher's film practice, at least at its best, can be. And I think that's what we have in Zodiac, a perfect genre film that illustrates the potential of the form to ask big questions, as well as a self-critical look at detail obsession and the possibilities of transforming a broken system, whether it be the SFPD and its inabilities to sort of communicate with other organizations as Zodiac, or a filmmaker like Fincher trying to create intensely personal art with a Hollywood budget and within the industry itself. What, Raj? How about that?
Well, there you have it, folks. Zodiac, approved by film critics, despised by dentists, I guess.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's going to do it for us for this episode. Hopefully the next movie we're going to be talking about is Paul Thomas Anderson's There Will Be Blood, hopefully in time for the latest film from the director called The Master, which should be releasing sometime in mid-September. So look out for that episode. And until then, thanks a lot for listening, and we hope to see you again shortly. Thrown like a star in my sleep, I opened my eyes to take a peek, to find that I was by the sea, gazing with tranquility. Just then when the hurdy-gurdy man came singing songs of love, then when the hurdy-gurdy